And it is today's Topical Currents, Thursday edition. Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. And this hour we visit with Tufts University social psychology professor Sam Summers. He specializes in research about how people think, communicate, and behave in diverse settings. He's written the book Situations Matter, Understanding How Context Transforms Your World. And Sam Summers joins us, oddly enough, from Somerville, Massachusetts. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Good to have you, Professor. I find it fascinating. Usually we're told, trust ourselves, trust our instincts and our judgment. And it seems that you're saying we shouldn't without at least considering the context or the situation. Is that correct?
Yeah, our instincts serve us pretty well for a lot of the decisions we make on a day-to-day basis to get us through what's a busy and otherwise complicated world out there. But if we really want to get a good read on other people and be best able to predict and understand why people behave the way they do, we do have to step back and pay attention to some of the contextual, the situational, as I talk about in the book, factors that we don't think about automatically.
So are you saying that our expectations of situations and people influence how we see those people and situations at any given moment?
That's part of it. I mean, the book is really about how the way that we think, the things that we do, the people that we are, how all of that is surprisingly context dependent, how we tend to gravitate towards the idea that there are these types of people, this person behaves this way because he is this type of person. And those are really shortcuts that, again, save us time and cognitive energy and serve us well up to a point. But a lot of human behavior is surprisingly context dependent, from how we behave in the presence of other people to whom it is we fall in love with and find ourselves repelled by. Those are all surprisingly context-dependent ideas, and that's really what the book focuses on.
Now, what about, what would Dr. Phil say? He has the idea that introspection gives true insight. I guess you'd disagree.
Well, right. If you think about even our private, innermost thoughts about who we are as people, our sense of identity, I think there's this notion that you hear about in the self-help aisle of the bookstore and on certain television shows, that there's this core self lurking within and we have to discover who that person is down deep within us. And what the research actually tells us is that even our sense of identity is surprisingly context dependent, that if you ask people to complete the following statement, I am blank, 10, 20 times, and just fill in the first words that come to mind, well, there are almost an infinite number of possibilities for how we complete something like that, and we give very different answers depending on who's asking and depending on who's sitting around us when we're asked and just depending on our immediate environment and point in time. And so we don't tend to think of the self as being as dynamic, as fluid as it really is, and there are times and there are endeavors for which that actually doesn't serve us well. We'd be much better off recognizing just how flexible and fluid and context-dependent even our own identities can be.
Hmm. Something that I was struck by in your book is you say voters will say and tell people that they're not influenced by negative political ads, but they are.
Yeah, there's always a very interesting disconnect for us as behavioral researchers between what everyone says is the reason they're doing something and what we can study in the research and find out to be the actual influences on what they're doing. And so negative campaigning is a good example. Everyone, it's like unanimous. The candidates themselves and the media pundits and the voters you talk to, they say, oh, they don't like that. Negative campaigning makes politics terrible. It should be somehow minimized. And yet it continues to happen because it works. And similarly, the idea of laugh tracks and television shows and sort of audience response, people don't think that that affects them in any way. They find it irritating, but it persists because it does have an influence on them. So we know from research findings that what people are very good at is we're very good storytellers. We're very good at coming up with an explanation for why we're doing something when you ask us why we're doing something or why we like something. But we're not always that reliable in our storytelling. We're not always even fully aware of what it is that's pushing us in different directions and making us behave the way we're behaving.
Well, going to that example you give about getting that airline ticket by saying your wife was pregnant when she wasn't.
Yeah, the opening story of the book.
What was really going on, that you just wanted the voucher for the hotel, but it was okay to misrepresent the situation?
Well, so the reason I start the book with that story is because this is really, it is a book about behavioral science. It's a book about research. It's a book about scientifically studying human behavior. But it's a book about day-to-day life and the realities and the mundane aspects of our day-to-day lives, from being stuck in traffic to being bullied around by the airlines to conversations with your significant others and dropping your kids off at school. And so the story there is one in which the moral of it is that we do a better job, we're more effective human beings at getting what it is that we're hoping to get when we step back and think about the context around ourselves and around our interactions, as opposed to having the sort of quick, knee-jerk emotional response we often have. So you get bumped from your flight and you wind up at the airline desk, and most people get furious and they're yelling at the desk agent, and they're understandably frustrated and they take it out on that person. And when you step back and sort of suss out the reality of the interaction you're having and figure out what the procedures are that are governing it and so forth, you actually often wind up with better outcomes. And so the book's not a self-help book. It's not about being necessarily a better person, quote-unquote. It's really about being a more effective person in a variety of domains. And that story, I think, tries to illustrate that idea.
You mentioned Harvard professor Dan Gilbert, who's been on this program and wrote the book about happiness. And he says, we're poor at anticipating what will make us happy. Give an example of that.
Yeah, the research is really... it's really fascinating in this domain, because again, we think of this as a really private and personal of judgment, that of course we know what we like and what makes us happy, but research study after research study shows you ask voters, for example, to go back to politics, how happy will they be if their candidate wins a given election, and they give you a response, but you track them over time and it turns out they're not nearly as happy when their candidate wins as they predicted they would be. They're not nearly as sad after the candidate loses as they predicted that they would have been, because when we make those kinds of predictions, we really focus in on that one thing we're asked about. We don't think about the totality of our lives, and that we're still stuck in the same traffic jams and still deriving the same pleasure for our relationship with our kids, despite what happens with our job promotion, with the election we're following, and so on and so forth. And so, again, even for these intimate of judgments, personal judgments like what makes us happy, there's a whole chapter in the book about falling in love and who we're attracted to. Even those things are surprisingly difficult for us to access and give a really reliable, consistent response about. They're really context-dependent as well.
Well, talk about that. You say that there isn't a Mr. or Mrs. Right, and that falling in love is just a matter of context?
Well, falling in love is just a matter of context is a line that, when I would say that my wife doesn't love that idea, and that's one that I think a lot of people would hear and recoil at. And so I guess I'm arguing for something a little bit more nuanced than that, just the idea that we put all of our eggs in, I think, the basket of this Mr. and Mrs. Right idea. We really think about attraction as, I have to find that person who encapsulates all of the characteristics that I'm looking for in somebody else. And I understand the appeal to that, and it's also at the same time very frustrating, because a lot of people spend all this time beating down the bushes looking for that Mr. or Mrs. Right. And what we know from the research is that a lot of contextual factors, a lot of aspects of our daily environment, are just as important in terms of proximity. Who do we cross paths with on a regular basis? Similarity, incredibly important in terms of who we are attracted to. Even things like the conditions in which we meet somebody, we are far more likely to be attracted to someone who we meet when we are otherwise physiologically aroused, so out for a run or working out at the gym or at a scary movie, for example, as opposed to when our heart rate is at a lower, more relaxed level and we don't have this sort of arousal to attribute and try to figure out where it's coming from. And so that's really the argument, is that, again, we're, even with love and attraction, a lot more flexible and a lot more context-dependent than we tend to think we are.
So if we're young and... A guy thinks that if he could marry that beautiful cheerleader, he can really never be happy. Or somebody who wants to marry the supermodel, or they can never be happy because they can never fulfill the expectations.
Well, we do, like we were talking about with Dan Gilbert's great work in his book and so forth, we don't do a great job of predicting what it is that will make us happy. And then when we think about other people, when we think about, say, falling in love and relationships, we have this very disposition-based, character-based idea that I've got to find this type of person, rather than recognizing that, well, you know, depending on where we find ourselves in our lives and which gym we join and which college we go to and which dorm they assign us to live in, we wind up with very different sets of intimate others, friends, platonic, as well as romantic relationships. And so recognizing that we are really flexible and can find attraction and love in places we weren't really expecting to is, I think, actually fairly empowering and sort of an optimistic conclusion about all this, rather than something that's not romantic or somehow depressing.
So if context is the crucial component, why do you think most people are blinded to it or ignore it? Is it just the easier way out, or it's something we've learned?
A little bit of something that we've learned. Our culture, Western culture as we call it in particular, has a real focus on sort of the rugged individual and the actor at the front of the scene as opposed to the background. It also, as you suggested, it's a way of imposing some sort of order over an otherwise unpredictable and sometimes scary and threatening world out there. The idea that, well, at least I understand people, and this person acts this way because he's that kind of person, and you know, she yelled at that person because she's impatient, and that's her personality. That gives us, that's somehow reassuring in a world in which so many things are unpredictable. The idea that we know what everyone's capable of, and we have a good read on who they are and what they will do, that's a reassuring thing, and it helps us, I think, navigate our complex and ambiguous social world a little bit more easily. And so I think that's the appeal of it, and that's why we tend to gravitate to that in that direction.
We're speaking with Professor Sam Summers. He's an award-winning social psychology professor at Tufts University. Name of the book is Situations Matter, Understanding How Context Transforms Your World. It's Topical Currents. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back.
And we're back. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. We resume our conversation with Professor Sam Summers. We're talking about his book, Situations Matter. If you'd like to join in, 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN. And email, that's radio@WLRN.org. radio@WLRN.org. Professor, how can we make appeals for assistance more effective? Is there an art of negotiation involved also?
Yeah, there is. There are, again, we think of, you know, we hear these stories about the bystander who's in need of, the individual who's in need of assistance in an emergency, and the bystanders don't do anything, and we sort of recoil in horror and jump to the idea that, well, these must be bad or callous or indifferent people, but again, there are aspects of situations that make all of us, you and me included, less likely to get involved in the affairs of others. When we're present in the presence of others, we sort of go with that crowd mentality, and if no one else seems concerned at what's going on in a situation, we assume it's not an emergency, or we assume someone else will take care of it, whether the emergency or the film at the movie, you know, the movie at the cinema that goes out of focus and no one does anything about it. And so what we can do when we need help is to try to break through that, to be very specific, to appeal to individuals and say, over there in the blue jacket, I think I'm having a heart attack, call 911. That might sound ridiculous, but that's sort of the prescription for breaking through this idea that otherwise the passerby might not know what you need or might not recognize it as an emergency or might not know how to engage in it. And so whether it's an emergency like that or whether it's a charity's appeal for assistance, breaking through those barriers and targeting individuals as individuals and being very specific about what they can do to offer assistance is a really important set of steps to take.
What
perhaps you consulted public radio pledge drives.
Right. Well, exactly. And we're actually doing, I have a colleague right now who's at Stanford who's in need of a desperate need of a bone marrow transplant. We're actually trying to apply some of these same procedures to try to get, in this case, South Asian individuals in particular into the donor database. And so it has applications for things from the life-saving to the fundraising, absolutely.
What about the person who can't ask for help if they're in some kind of a situation? Doesn't it fall on us to take some responsibility?
It does. And I think one of the points that I try to make in the book, I said earlier that, you know, it's not really a self-help book. It's not a book that's designed to make us, quote unquote, better people. But it does have that potential, because I think that learning about these obstacles to getting involved in others' affairs, learning about the obstacles that keep us likely to just ignore or delete the mass email in a way that we wouldn't the individually directed email to us, that's powerful. And when you learn about these tendencies we have to overlook others in a crowd or to assume someone else will take care of it, it becomes hard to see the world in the same way after you've known, recognize that fact. And so I think when we become educated and do a better job of recognizing context around us and how it's pushing us in different directions, we become less likely to, for example, walk by someone who's in need in that kind of an environment. And so I think educating ourselves about, you know, the true nature of human nature is not only empowering, but also has that potential to make us recognize the things that we might not otherwise recognize and take action where we might not otherwise take action.
You refute the conventional wisdom about gender differences, saying our expectations and intuitions cloud the picture. So just how mistaken are we, and what are some of your findings?
I'd say we're pretty mistaken, because I think that, that sex differences gives you a really good example of just how we gravitate towards an internal sort of, again, personality or intrinsic-based explanation for things. And so we hear that the latest research finding about men and women and their differences on spatial skills or you know, so navigation and spatial skills or romantic preference or whatever the topic is, and we think, well, that's got to be because of differences in hormone levels or differences in how the male and female brain have evolved over time, and men are from Mars and women are from Venus. And clearly there are very obvious biological differences between the sexes, but we tend to overplay that, and in reality you find that a lot of what we assume to be pretty entrenched and immutable sex differences are, again, surprisingly context-dependent. So give college students, a high-achieving college students, a standardized math test, you know, your average male student will perform higher than your average female student. Give them the exact same test, however, and tell them it's a test that's been pre-tested and determined to have no sort of gender bias whatsoever, and that difference suddenly goes away, showing that a lot of what's going on there is not about intrinsic aptitude, but more about the expectations one has for taking a test like that, the expectations you have for what others think about you in a math-related domain, and so forth. And so the book has a whole lot of examples all along those lines when it comes to sex differences.
We have an emailer. Robin says, Edwin Hall had a famous book regarding contextual and non-contextual languages. It was a bestseller for almost 20 years. She says, ask if you are expanding the idea to say, actually, context matters for us, too. But she wanted us to mention this best-known book. Are you aware of that book?
Edwin Hall. He's a physicist, I think. Is that right?
She didn't say. She just said he has
she
a...
She didn't say.
No.
That's my... I believe that's what the Edwin Hall that I'm familiar with. I mean, what I'm writing about is, by, I will admit, full right now in full, that it's not... This is not an idea that is just my idea or that is just coming up here for the first time with the publication of this book. The book is really an effort to tell the story about an entire field of research of social psychology that really tries to ground our human psychology, our cognitive psychology, in a more social context. And so it covers research that has been done by a wide range of different scholars over the years, and really tries to cast a broad net and talks about things, again, ranging from how we behave in emergency situations and in crowds, and how we, again, fall in love, to it is a chapter on intergroup conflict and prejudice, and the one we just talked about sex differences. So it really is trying to apply this perspective to a wide array of walks of life that are related to all of our experiences, both professionally and personally on a day-to-day basis.
Sam Summers, how about a website where people can learn more about you and the book?
Absolutely. It's easy. It's www.samsummers.com, and that's SAMSOMMERS. And
as in Elkie.
Yeah, you can also find more info on the book on Amazon and other websites.
We had a guest yesterday who wrote about people who defy authority, and his name is Eyal Press, and the name of the book was Beautiful Creatures. And he was talking about people that actually, whistleblowers or the like, or people that stand up against very unfair practices. So what about those who act heroically, or those who act egregiously or unethically? Are those behaviors context-dependent, do you feel?
Well, those are really interesting case studies at the individual level, and the book actually goes into some of those details as well with regard to, well, the Abu Ghraib prison scandal several years ago with U.S. Military personnel. And so there is an extensive body of research that's tried to look at these questions of, you know, authority. When are we most susceptible to being influenced by authority? Are there specific personality types that are more or less susceptible to obedience to authority? And what we find from the research is that it's a pretty ubiquitous human tendency, that this idea that we tend to go along with an authority figure unless we have really have to fight hard against that, to fight against that tendency. And so the examples of individuals who've been able to do that, who have served as whistleblowers or who have stood up and voiced their opposition to what the masses or what authority figures were suggesting are really valuable for us, because they help us try to get a sense of what it is that enables us to, at some level, fight against what's a pretty basic human tendency to go along with the flow and to take cues and to follow what an authority figure conveys to us, either explicitly or even more implicitly.
It was interesting because most of the people that he found were ordinary people who had really did extraordinary things and weren't recognized for it till, in many cases, over half a century later.
Yeah, and I think that's the case for the standout cases of people who have really done heroic things, as well as often people who have done things on the other side of the ledger that they turn out to be surprisingly ordinary, which I think speaks to this importance of understanding how context can push us in different directions.
So does it boil down to that most people really have no idea what shapes their behavior?
Well, we have a decent idea, right? Most of us are able to get through the day and do a fairly good job, some better than others, obviously. But I, what I'd argue is that a lot of our assumptions turn out to be somewhat misplaced, and that we don't really fully appreciate the ways in which the people around us and ourselves as well are much more flexible and fluid than we tend to give them credit for. And so the book is really about not completely reworking the way we think about other people, because we do have some intuitions that serve us quite well, but rather giving us a more complete picture and leaving us so that we don't put all of our eggs in this basket of, well, this is people and people are stable personality types, but opening our eyes to the idea that there are other factors at play here too.
So when judging others, we should consider where they are, who they're with, and our own expectations?
I think that's a great way to sum it up. That's a great way to put it.
How can we make better decisions and observations about people?
Well, I guess I would suggest that we guard against the quick emotional response, that we guard against the jumping to the conclusions that I know who this person is, the kind of person this is, and I know where this is going. I mean, those intuitions sometimes serve us well, but again, the people who are best at reading other people, so the successful salesperson or the dynamic public speaker, they're really good at sensing the ways in which you can frame a message, you can frame a situation or an interaction or a negotiation in a way that's most advantageous towards the goals you're trying to accomplish. And so thinking about who you're dealing with, absolutely important, but also thinking about under what context, in what set of circumstances, under what previously established precedent, those are all incredibly important for being successful, whether it's negotiating a raise or a new job, or for that matter negotiating bedtime with your children. And so I think it plays out in a variety of different domains.
We just got an email from Robin. She was saying that he was a book. The name of the book was Beyond Culture, that Edwin Hall wrote.
Okay.
Well, we certainly want to thank you, Professor Sam Summers of Tufts University, and his book is Situations Matter: Understanding How Context Transforms Your World. Thank you very much, Professor.
Thanks, Professor.
Sure. Thanks so much for having me.
Food and Dining is next. And we return. It is today's Topical Currents, Thursday edition. Joseph Cooper here, along with Bonnie Berman. Finally, Thursday's Food and Dining Extravaganza has arrived. I'm joined by my friend, chef, author, and syndicated columnist, Linda Gassenheimer. Linda, there's gourmet mac and cheese here for us. Who can ask for more than that with truffles?
It's the aroma all over the studio. It is just amazing. But now, while everyone's drooling, have you noticed how many big name chefs have opened restaurants in South Florida? And sometimes they're a great success, and other times they disappear.
Mysteriously.
Right.
They even have good locations and they have great food, but
they're gone. I mean, look at Emeralds at the Lowe's. Mm-hmm. He's gone.
Danny DeVito.
Right, gone. So what are the secrets to a top quality restaurant? And our guests have some answers for us. Gustavo Reck is the general manager of the celebrity chef Michael Minas Bourbon Steak at Turnberry Isle. And welcome, Gustavo.
Hi, Linda. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. And joining us later will be David Varley. He's Michael Mina's corporate chef at the Mina Group of Restaurants. And we'll welcome him as soon as we have him on air. And also joining us, welcoming him, our favorite wine columnist, Fred Tasker. He's joining us by Skype, and he writes the wine suggestions for my Dinner Minutes column. And you can read Fred's column in today's Miami Herald. Fred, what are we drinking today?
Oh, man, we're talking about red meat and red wine, my favorite topic.
Mm-hmm. What about the mac and cheese?
Yeah.
Oh, we'll get to that, too. Don't worry. There you need comfort wine.
Okay. I can guess what that is. We'll find out later. We'd love to hear from you, our listeners. What makes a successful restaurant? Do you have any suggestions or questions? Give us a call, 800-743-9576. That's 800-743-WLRN.
Our email is radio at WLRN.org.
Okay. So I got a call, or an email, actually, from a listener. And I asked, you know, what's your pet peeve in a restaurant? And here's the answer. Number one, service. Number two, bad food. Number three, she said, the best restaurants are those that make the customer feel special.
Number four, loud music.
Right. Okay. Absolutely.
That sounds like a personal problem, Joe.
I think so, friend.
And she says, I find it very surprising that I can't find a restaurant to go back to. Well, with that introduction, Gustavo, let's solve her problems. Tell me something. You're general manager of Bourbon Steak. What do you do to create a fascinating vibe there?
Well, I think the first thing that we do at the restaurant, and the Mina Group backs us up at everything we do when it comes to training, it's the most important thing in the restaurant. I mean, a knowledgeable staff, it's a confident staff. And I think that's what people want when they come to the restaurant. Also, recognition. It's a big one. We know everybody that comes to the restaurant. When we go into our pre-shift, so it lasts about half an hour every day, we know who's coming. We know what they like. We know what they don't like, which is more important.
How do you do that?
Well, we gather information throughout the time. You know, first time they come in, if we say, I hate garlic, well, that's going to go in the notes at the reservation. Next time they come in, we're going to ask the guy before he even says, would you like your meal without garlic today?
You make them feel comfortable and at home. And, you know, in today's world, a computerized world and service, there's no excuse not to.
Absolutely.
Now, you say to me the staff is so important, and you train your staff. So how do you find good staff?
Well, that's a difficult one. But we definitely don't stereotype who we're looking for, but we're looking for hungry people that want to learn more, that not necessarily know everything, but are definitely willing to keep learning.
So they didn't have to have experience?
Some, absolutely. We're always looking for some experience. In a restaurant of our caliber, you're always looking for some experience. But more important than that, we're looking for people that are willing to learn still.
So when you, because we get so many people, not so many, we get a few people who call in and say, you know, how can I get into hospitality business? What do I have to do? So what's your advice?
Well, you got to love it first. You can't do it if you don't love it. That's the first thing. If you do it for the money, you definitely do it for the wrong reasons in there. But to get in, it's you got to get your feet wet somehow. And I started as a dishwasher. And I made my way to a cook and a server and a bartender and assistant manager and a general manager today. You just got to be eager and be a go-getter.
So, and you have to put in your time.
You have to put in your time.
I mean, we get so many young people out of culinary school and they think they're going to be a star immediately.
Well, yeah, we wish it happened that way, but it doesn't.
When you first go into a restaurant, not your own, what's the first thing you look for? I mean, an excellent restaurant. What's the first thing you look for to indicate quality?
Cleanliness. I think that's the first thing I look at it. I look into the floors and make sure it's clean. I make sure the place looks clean. The staff looks neat. I look at their nails, see if they're done properly. I think I'm a clean freak. So in my restaurant, I lead that way. I make sure that my staff understands if there's a piece of paper on the floor, it's your responsibility to pick it up. It's my responsibility to pick it up. Everybody. It's just not, the server assistant will pick it up. No, everybody's job is to keep
the place
clean.
So if things aren't up to par in that area, you know there's going to be difficulties down the road.
Yeah. As you go to the kitchen, you're just going to see that trend happening again.
Well, if the restaurant's not clean, you can only imagine
how the kitchen will look like. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, that's interesting. So tell me something. Food, of course, is important, as this person wrote in. Bad food. So you brought here this truffled mac and cheese from a steak restaurant. Tell us about it.
Well, it's one of our signatures, truffle mac and cheese. You can't go wrong. You have white cheddar, Parmesan cheese, blue cheese mixed with the velouté, perigold black truffles on it. I mean, you can't go wrong with that.
It has some broccoli in it, too.
And it has broccoli, absolutely. But I missed that part. I missed the healthy part of it.
Okay, right, right. But it's hidden, so don't worry about it. It's not too healthy.
We can make without it.
So do you... So you use real truffles, not just truffle oil?
No, we use real truffles. Yeah, we shave perigold truffles on it. Yes,
It's a wonderful, wonderful aroma.
What's the price of truffles these days?
Ask Gustavo.
Perigold truffles are not that expensive. Now, if you go for white Alba truffles, then we had an event in the restaurant. We bought like a pound, and it was about $2,000.
Yeah.
Oh my God! So, well, the perigold must be close. How much?
No, they're not that expensive. $50
a pound?
Yeah.
That isn't too bad.
No, it isn't
too bad.
There's
a lot of truffles in a pound.
No, we do put a lot of truffles in our dishes. I mean, when they're in season, of course.
Well, you have a truffled French fried potatoes.
Those are delicious.
Yes, you put those on the table and the rest of the meal, forget it. that's something else. So that recipe sounds wonderful. Will you send it to us and we can put it up on
absolutely.
The web?
Absolutely. Yes? I'll email it to you as soon as possible.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, the mac and cheese was very comforting, Fred.
Oh, I'm glad to hear it. And the idea of having truffles in it is just fabulous.
Now, we're still trying to get a hold of David Varley, who is the corporate chef for the MENA Group. Now, Gustavo, he makes the recipes. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
Well, he gives ideas of things that he would like us to use. Let's say he's got a new fish, and he says, you know, can you create something with that? But he does give each chef the time to do it and do their own dish, whichever way they would like it. So not necessarily we do something, we don't do anything corporate-wise. Even the signature dishes that we have on our menu, Chef Michael Mina says, you know, we have lobster pot pie. Would you carry on your restaurant? Absolutely. But you can do your own twist on it.
Oh, so he gives you the ideas for it. Because I was at another celebrity chef restaurant where the celebrity chef keeps such tight controls that he sends a book with photographs. An exact amount that must go into each recipe. And they have to stick to it, and they're checked up quite often on that.
Well, every recipe that we do and we create, we send it to corporate for approval.
Oh, you
do? And it gets approved by them, and then it comes back to the restaurant, and that's when we, you know, work on plating and how it's going to look like. But everything goes to corporate and then comes back to us again.
How important is it that the celebrity chef visits the restaurant often?
Very important. Very important. Well, one for PR. Let's get started with that. When he's around, there's always a lot of people that come to the restaurant, and it keeps everybody on their toes. I mean, you always.
Linda, I think I've heard you mention that you can tell when the chef is there and when it isn't there in a lot of restaurants because of the quality of the food.
Yes, absolutely. It makes a big difference.
But that shouldn't be, should it?
You absolutely are right about that. It shouldn't make a difference if it's that or not. And that's how we do a bourbon steak. Every day, it's game day. You know, there's no, today we're going to cook a little less, tomorrow we're going to cook better. No, it's consistency.
When, you know, the chef has a bad day, or he's not there, or there's a fight in the kitchen, or whatever.
Well, there's a lot of people in the kitchen that cook. So, I mean, the chef, basically, he does the final touches on the plate. He plates the food. He puts it together. And usually we run the kitchen with three chefs back there, just expediting.
So they all know.
So they all work together. Maybe if one is having a bad day, the other one will carry him over.
Is one of them the boss?
Michael Mean itself?
No, I mean, if you have three chefs, are they all equal, or does one of them supervising you?
There's one executive chef, one executive sous chef, and then a sous chef.
I see.
Okay, well, we're talking about what makes a successful restaurant with the general manager of the Bourbon Steak at Turnberry Isle, and that's Gustavo Reck. We'll take a short break here, and we'll be back with more. And we're back. I'm Linda Gassenheimer, and we're talking about celebrity chef restaurants. We're also talking about why some restaurants fail and others succeed, and we've been getting some great advice and some information from Gustavo Reck. He's the general manager at Bourbon Steak, Michael Mina's Bourbon Steak at Turnberry Isle.
What's the most popular steak cut at the restaurant?
Definitely what we sell the most would be a filet mignon, and second would be a New York strip.
Oh. And how are they prepared? What separates you from the others?
Well, we butter poach our steaks.
Butter poach?
Yes.
Ooh.
Wait, butter?
Yes.
Butter poach? What does that mean?
Well, we use clarified butter, and the steaks stay in there for a little while before they actually go to the wood grill, which makes a lot of difference as well when you're cooking.
It stays in the butter over the heat?
No.
Just on its own?
We just keep the clarified butter at a certain temperature just to keep it the steaks in there for a certain time.
And then onto the grill.
And then onto the grill.
I'll have to try that
any
on my Weber kettle.
Any spices or garlic in the butter?
Oh, my God. Joe's on his way.
What, friend?
Any flavorings in the butter? Any garlic? Any spices?
We do use a few spices on, and we can exactly go and what they
proprietary.
Are.
Proprietary.
Exactly.
We'll get it out of you if we can.
Yeah, we'll try. Okay, so it's dinner in minutes time. And we've been talking about steak. In case you're drooling and you need a steak, here's a quick and easy steak for you. It's a juicy dinner, and this one won't break your calorie bank. It's mushroom pesto steak with a hot pepper potatoes.
Sounds good.
Let me tell you, it's really simple and easy. Thick sliced portobello mushrooms are the basis for the sauce. And what I've done to make it quick and easy is I buy a prepared pesto sauce and I saute some portobello mushrooms for just a few minutes. And then I chop them up in a food processor with the pesto sauce. So that makes it real simple and easy. And then in that same skillet where the mushrooms were, I saute the steak about a couple of minutes each side. Depends if you want it to be rare or not rare, 145 for medium rare. And then you just put the pesto sauce on top. Couldn't be easier. Really, really simple. And then hot pepper potatoes that take only a minute, I put them in the microwave. And then I brown them with a little garlic in that same skillet the steak came out of. So you cut up the potatoes, put them in the microwave, and then take the steak out and brown up the potatoes.
All that in 15 minutes?
Of course.
And what's the pepper?
There's hot pepper sauce on it. Sorry. Didn't tell you about that.
Okay.
Yeah, we have to put some hot pepper sauce on it. You know I don't like hot pepper sauce.
So you forgot it.
But everybody else does, so I've put it in for you, okay? The heat's up to you. And that whole recipe and a photograph is at dinnerinminutes.com. And please follow me on Twitter. That's at L. Gassenheimer. Fred, what are we drinking?
Oh, picture this, a 2-pound New York strip steak and a bottle of California Cabernet Sauvignon. It's one of the finest duets ever created.
I can see the smile on your face.
Better than Brad and Angelina. Better than Taylor Swift and, well, I guess I won't go there.
Well, he's into the pop
culture.
Anyway,
the reason is that when you take a bite of steak and you chew it and you swallow it, it leaves your palate with a thin film of, let's face it, fat. Beautiful, tasty fat, but it's still fat. So the logical next step is a sip of Cabernet Sauvignon, because it's a big, bold red wine that has bitter tannin and astringent acid that strip away the fat and leave the palate refreshed for the next bite.
So you're deglazing in your mouth.
Oh, that's very good. Then you take another bite and another sip and you know, rinse and repeat. Of course, not all steaks are created equal. As our guest was saying, a bite of filet mignon contains hardly any fat at all. So a Cabernet Sauvignon might actually be excessive, and you could probably sip something softer, even a Pinot Noir or something like that. And that, I think, is why real red meat fans prefer to pay half the price and get a good old ribeye steak. Because ribeyes have great marbling, which, of course, is a euphemism for lots of fat. And here's where you break out that big, powerful Cabernet Sauvignon. I know it sounds unhealthy, but the I guess the saving grace is that researchers say powerful red wine makes your blood platelet slippery so the fat doesn't clog your arteries so much, although I'm not saying this is sufficient. Now, macaroni and cheese is another matter altogether. The reason it's considered a comfort food is that it's rich and creamy and soft and unctuous. I mean, you hardly even need to swallow or you need to chew it. So the main thing that it needs in a wine, of course, is something with crisp enough acids to cut through all that creaminess, which, again, is all that fat. This is good because it means that you can go with either a white wine or a red wine, depending on what you feel like drinking.
If you want something white, you could go with, guess what, Linda? I have a suspicion, Fred, yes. My suspicion is going to be...
Sparkling wine?
Yes, right.
Yeah, I mean, what's crisper with brighter acids than a bottle of bubbly?
Uh-huh, but... I was right.
Yep. Of course, a comfort food doesn't require $100 French champagne. This would create discomfort in your wallet. So I think a nice $10 Spanish Cava style sparkling wine would be fine.
How about Prosecco, Fred?
That would be the same thing, yeah. Prosecco is inexpensive, and that would be an excellent thing to use. And, of course, if you prefer a red wine and you're looking for those crisp acids, you could go with an inexpensive Italian Chianti or even an Italian Barbera or something that has a little crisp acid to it. So it's a delicious way to go.
It sure is. Well, tell me, Gustavo Reck, at Bourbon Steak, what wines do you serve with these foods?
Well, we serve what guests want, but basically Cabernet Sauvignon is what we sell the most at the restaurant by far. It's definitely our big sellers. Also, we go into Rhone. We sell a lot of Rhone in there, Côte de Rhone from France. Italian wines and Spanish wines sell really, really well. Tempranillos do really well at the restaurant as well. Barolo. So big wines, they usually go really well with steaks.
Are you able to have some wines that have some age on them?
Absolutely.
You have a big wine wall there.
Yeah, we do. About 1,000 different bottles.
So there's something to choose from. But now, what's the price range? Because Fred and I have always talking about, you know, of course you expect to spend some money for the wine, but do you have something at the lower range?
Absolutely. We do have a page on our list called Secrets of the Sommelier, and we do range wines between $45 to $100, $125, and there's more than 30 wines in that page. Plus, you know, as you search throughout the other, you know, regions, you'll find wines at $50, $45. 70. Mm-hmm. So we have every category of wine when it comes to price. We go from the cheapest to some of the most expensive wines.
All right.
We won't go there.
Well, let's go back to something that Joe mentioned earlier in the program, and that's noise in the restaurant. It's so difficult because, as we mentioned, chefs want to have a vibe. They say that you need to have the vibe, you need to have the noise, people won't be happy. But people aren't happy if you... I mean, I've been at restaurants where the waiter can't even hear me, not let alone the people I'm with. So how do you... Because I know you have a vibe at Bourbon Steak, but how do you handle that?
Well, I think the first thing you want to, when you go out to have dinner, is you want a little bit of privacy. So we definitely give enough space in between tables so people can... You don't have to hear what whoever's next to you is saying. Also, we feel that the music at the restaurant should never be louder than what you were speaking. You should never have to speak louder than... If you want to sit down at the restaurant and have dinner. If it's too noisy, then it's...
And not heavy metal.
And not heavy metal. Well, we do have a progressive playlist that, you know, goes up and down. And, you know, it's, sometimes you get 80s, you get 90s, even some new thing from the 2000s as well. But nothing too heavy, absolutely not.
Often it's the acoustics I find in restaurants that make for so
hardwood
much noise.
Hardwood floors.
And open ceiling and where the sound is just bouncing around.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And I noticed that you, at your restaurant, although it's big, it's expansive, it doesn't feel that way because it's kind of in little pods, which is probably a good idea.
Well, when you dim the lights at night and you have all the effects from the mirrors or from the lights, it feels really welcoming and warm inside of the restaurant. That was the idea of Tony Chi when he actually created the restaurant, was to kind of give a fire impression as you have those lights and you're looking at the mirrors.
Right. Now, one more point before we leave. I know that Michael Mina is opening a restaurant at the Fontainebleau. And he has a smile on his face, and his lips are closed, Gustavo.
Well,
yes?
We hear things. I don't think there's anything signed yet, but definitely there has been conversations, and hopefully he will get one restaurant, right. And that I think will be great for him and for everybody else in the city. He has great restaurants.
All right. Okay. Well, it's been a very, very tasty week.
Indeed.
Gustavo Reck, General Manager of Bourbon Steak at Turnberry Isle, thank you for joining us.
It was a pleasure to be here.
And the recipe today is at dinnerandminutes.com.
It will be. He's going to send it to me. Yes.
Thank you, Gustavo.
Thank you.
Yes. And that food's wonderful. And Fred Tasker, wine columnist. Great advice as always.
Always a pleasure.
Joe Cooper and Bonnie. Boy, you really ate well today.
That mac and cheese. Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yes.
Okay. Well, next week we're going to be talking about Veritage, a new name for the United Way Gala and Royal Caribbean Chair. Richard Fain is going to be with us. I'm Linda Gassenheimer. Join us then.
And that wraps us up today. Our producer is Richard Ive. Technical direction from Paul Leary. Free audio archives and downloads at our website. That's WLRN.org. And the Topical Currents Facebook page gives additional details. Of course, tomorrow at 1, it's Ed Bell and the South Florida Arts Beat. Monday, we look into the psychology behind winning in sports or other endeavors with journalist and author Poe Bronson. He's written Top Dog. And the calendar on this day in 1992, 21 years ago, the death of Sam Walton, founder of Walmart, of course, of cancer at age 74. The first true Walmart opened in 1962 in Arkansas. Also on this day in 1915, 98 years ago, the birth of the Hoochie Coochie Man, Muddy Waters in one of my favorite towns, Rolling Form, Mississippi. And on this day at 6:01 p.m. Central Time, 1968, civil rights icon Dr. Martin Luther King is cut down by sniper James Earl Ray in Memphis, Tennessee, at the Lorraine Motel. Outside room 306. King was 39. Our theme music, conducted and composed by Michael Levine. And we leave with a thought from Muddy Waters, quote, "Saturday night is your big night. Everybody used to fry up fish and have one hell of a time and find me playing till sunrise for 50 cents and a sandwich and be glad of it." This is Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. Thanks for making Public Radio your companion today. Stay tuned now for the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.